This episode of The Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers, the professional's gateway to the world's markets. Their clients enjoy enhanced price execution via IB smart routing and lowest cost access to stocks, options, futures, and fixed income, all from a single integrated account. Learn more at IBKR.com.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Vroom! Markets sporting higher on stimulus hopes. Weakness in employment reports is confirming our outlook. Overbought conditions, well, they won't matter, of course, until it matters. And the 10-year Treasury bumping up towards 1%. All this and much more on episode number 691 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a very good day to you, Andrew Horowitz here, and welcome to the home stretch. Getting towards the end of the year, final month, December is upon us. And for those of you newcomers, I want to welcome you and thank you for listening. And just let you know, I am, just because maybe you don't know, I'm the founder and the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, going on over 12 years now. I'm also the founder of Horowitz & Company, investment advisory firm. We manage money. I mean, it's pretty basic what we do, although possibly something that you're not used to, as we talk about in real time here on the podcast each and every week, the things that we're talking about in the office and what I am looking at from a market perspective, as well as other areas of finance and financial planning. So we do that and get on with that. And, you know, basically there is just a host of information between the guests that we have each and every week, as well as the topics that we bring, that hopefully will help educate you. It also, you know, it helps me because I bring on these guests and I get to hear all the good things they're talking about on a regular basis. Before we go any further, I have a couple of personal quick shout outs that I wanted to do, because today, which is Sunday, the 6th of December, it's a very special day for my twins, my daughters, turning 30 today. Lauren and Erica, two amazing women. Want to wish you the best birthday. Keep on being wonderful. I'm very proud of both of you. Now, there's another set of twins that actually came into our lives as well. Kevin, who's worked with me for over, 10, 11, 12 years, he and his wife, Allison, just welcomed two wonderful little boys, twin boys. Happy birthday to them as well. Happened this week. Can't wait to meet the fellas. And the good news for us, well, more crew for fishing, right? Two guys coming into the play. So it's going to be pretty cool. Pretty cool. Now, I want to talk about something. Over the last so many years, we've had an incredible amount of great guests and conversations, and many of you may agree with, and some you may not. And that's exactly what we're trying to do. The whole point of having guests is to foster the conversation and try to get down to what is really the baseline of how we look at markets and finance and your money, and therefore helping you make really good decisions. Okay, so let's talk about from the not category, those that you may not agree with. I got a lot of emails this week over a discussion I had in last week's podcast episode with Frank Curzio. And when I say plenty, several. Let's just say that. And the topic in particular was all about COVID and the potential need for lockdowns or not, and statistics. And Frank was making the case that, well, it's not as bad as the media was promoting. And I pushed back a little bit, yes, for what I thought was, you know, just this brief moment of this discussion about statistical analysis and all. And I said something to the effect of, hey, you know what? It's all statistics until it happens to you. And then it's like, oh my gosh, what is that all about? But to be honest, I probably should have pushed back a little bit more because, you know, I really didn't agree necessarily with some of the things he was talking about. But again, I want to move beyond this and get into some of the topics about, you know, all right, how does this all affect markets? Where should we be looking? What should we be investing in and all? And the thought that when we look at this in a very methodical, numbers-based analysis of, well, you know, there's this many people that catch it, this disease, and then have to go into the hospital, but it's really going down, and this is going up, and we shouldn't be worried about it, and or not, whatever it is. Again, I think that the statistics don't really necessarily tell the whole story. But there's something I think we need to really think about, and that is that the whole point of bringing guests on is to really flush out their thoughts and to really come with what it is that they're talking about, thinking about, and how we can then assimilate that into what we're doing. Because if we are exposed only to ideas that we agree with, that confirmation bias and echo chamber is not going to help us. I mean, if you're a CNN watcher or a Fox News watcher, or you like MSNBC, or you just like to watch BBC, it doesn't matter. You know what? I've always said you should float around all the different channels and look at all the different sides so that you can get all the different angles and how you could then put it all together. Because never is any one opinion on any topic really just the absolute be all. And that's why I bring on these guests, to really educate you with all the different sides of the discussion, of the topics that are out there. Now, obviously, this particular topic, along with politics, okay, is one of these really hot ones, you know, this hot potato that we need to be dealing with, and everybody is triggered. It's a flashpoint, and it's understandable, totally, 100%. Some took offense to the discussion with Frank, and I get it. I totally understand. But again, we want opinions that are relatable to markets. And sometimes those discussions wander into areas that, well, are just not that comfortable. And unfortunately, we all need to kind of take that with a grain of salt and recognize that not every area of the topics we discuss on this show are going to be necessarily comfortable. I mean, especially these days, right? So what I want you to do is take from what we talk about with the guests, or for that matter, when I'm talking, take what is best, what fits you the best, and look through some of the areas they're not that comfortable with, but keep them. Keep that information, that discussion point, to really look at maybe the other side of, well, on the other hand, because I think we always need to look at that. Because if we always look at just the things that we want to look at, a lot of times we're going to be wrong, and we're not going to be necessarily utilizing all the information to provide us with the best solution and direction. So let's focus on the financial impacts of these discussions and how they may help you. I think that's really important. I just want to kind of end cap and kind of throw a lot at you there from last week's discussion. But I enjoy your email, so you can always go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, click on the Ask Andrew button, and then send me your emails, whatever the topic is. And I do appreciate your feedback, and I do appreciate your pushback if there's something that you think is really not agreeable to you. That's the whole point, having a discussion and doing it in a very constructive way. So what are we going to talk about this week? I think we're going to start with something that just for a brief moment, because I think this particular topic is interesting. And it spreads out to a lot of different areas with regard to the future look of what we're doing. Because right now we are sitting here in 2020 after 4 years and maybe even more, but let's just look back to the last administration where we saw a very favorable environment for taxes, both individual and corporate. And here we are possibly entering into the next phase of not only a new administration, but I think a necessity to pay back some of the money that we borrowed. I mean, we're not talking about like 50 cents or a dollar here. We're talking about trillions. Eventually, somehow, some way, we're going to have to pay that back. And if we have to do that, the question is how? And the obvious answer then is, well, we're going to have to probably raise taxes over time. Now, that doesn't mean I am telling you I am for or against it. I'm telling you that I think it's going to happen. Now, obviously, a higher tax rate on corporations is going to be very difficult if we see that going from the 21% that we have now up to the 28% that we were just a few years back. Obviously, that is going to constrain margins and profitability. We know that. And that turns into a problem for stocks. Okay, I get it. But I really want to focus in on your taxes, and in particular, two items. Number one, thinking about the future with relation to, okay, here we are in 2020, right button up at the end of the year where, you know, after the end of the year, any of the tax moves that I make right now will count for 2020. But you know what? You turn that dial 1 second after midnight on 2020 into 2021, and that's it. Nothing you do anymore for 2020 qualifies and counts for 2020. Now, even if we do get some higher taxes into the future, do I think that is going to be in 2020, even if legislation somehow miraculously gets through all the different avenues and signed into law that we do see an increase somehow in taxes, do I even think it's going to be in 2020? I'm not quite sure. Probably 2022. By the time you get it around to getting it all done and you don't want to go retroactive because you don't want to slow down the economy in a recovery setting. So, you know, probably push it off a little bit. So what then can I think about doing? So you want to think about, for example, for those of you, and this is the big one, for those of you that are in the age group where you're required to take an IRA RMD, the required minimum distribution from your IRA. One of the things that we know that in 2020, through the CARES Act, the requirement for taking that distribution has been waived. You don't have to take it. However, we have counseled our clients, generally speaking, I mean, it's a case-by-case basis, but generally speaking, you know what? Let's take that money this year because we don't know what the tax implications of distributions will be in the future. And as such, why not take those distributions now, pay the lower that we think it's going to be at least, lower tax rate that we're going to have in the future, convert that into your money in your ordinary account, therefore starting to establish investments, utilizing it for capital gains at a lower tax rate than ordinary income. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense. Our clients agree as well. They're willing to take the slight tax hit on this, as they've done every year historically on their RMDs, because they realize that if they also take it out of their IRA now, they're not going to have the future growth necessarily that's tax deferred, therefore yielding a larger amount, hopefully, in the future, therefore having even more money that is going to be taxable. So this whole thing works out pretty nicely. Now, there's also another possibility for those of you that are not yet of the age, which is 70 and a half or 72 right now, 72, where you have to take your RMD, or maybe if you are in a situation where you're taking required minimum distributions from an inherited IRA, well, you also have a few things to think about. Number one, what taxes are embedded in some of your investments right now outside of an IRA that you may be looking at, well, maybe I should convert some of that, pay the tax right now, and then reinvest somewhere. But more importantly, what about those IRAs that you have? I'm not talking about the 401ks. I'm not talking about your 403bs, your 457s. I'm talking about those IRAs that you have. And have you done an analysis to take a look at if it's eligible to be converted to a Roth IRA? And if that is the case, what's the tax implications? And how does that play out from now into the future? Because if we do believe that this is an unsustainable amount of debt that we have on the books right now, from the federal government that will have to be brought down over time. And the probability is that this whole notion that, well, you know, bring down taxes and then we have more growth, and that more growth creates more taxes just on a dollar for dollar basis, thereby extinguishing the debt over time, it doesn't work. They tried that several times, trickle-down economics as well as this whole lower tax base. There's a sweet spot, but it's not working in that manner. And they're going to have to probably tweak the tax code over the future. So let's just kind of think about that. And if that's the case, if you convert part or all of your IRA from an IRA into a Roth IRA, therefore allowing for tax-deferred growth on that, and then eventually taking out the money tax-free in a higher tax rate environment sometime in the future, that makes a lot of sense. So many of you that are young, and let's call it under 40, again, you can run all these different calculations of whether or not it makes sense. But if you're under 40, let's just use that, and you have an IRA, thinking about a partial or a full conversion to a Roth IRA at this point could really be meaningful long term, especially if we put into that calculation that your tax bracket is, I'm just going to use a random percentage here, 25% today on your average to, let's call it, 30% in the future. And you run these numbers utilizing that schematic and basis of the calculation, you're probably going to see there's a significant amount of savings in the future. Now, you'll have to take the hit now, and frankly, that's tough. However, of course, you can use this opportunity as something, at least from now to the end of the year, to look into it, to run those numbers, and find out all the details. Obviously, contact your CPA, contact your financial advisor, find out what it's all about and where the impact is. And probably more importantly, you know, where am I going to get the taxes from to pay for this? How am I going to do this? And what level should I do this or should I not? And does it make sense? The longer period you have for this to grow on a tax-deferred basis and then eventually take out the money on a tax-free basis on the back end of the Roth IRA, you know, it looks a lot better on paper under a lot of circumstances. So something to really think about right now. Again, contact your professional advisors to run these numbers, and you have to do it by the end of this year if you want to do it for 2020. Not that there's necessarily a mad rush to do so, but I think it's a really good time to at least consider it. The other thing that I want to kind of get into a little bit is there's been a lot of interest in our discussions about the area of inflation and how that concept may affect markets. And also about, well, what are we seeing with bond yields lately? And is it all interrelated? Because right now the 10-year is approaching right about 1% that we saw at the end of the week last week. Now, not that this is really this important level. It's not like, oh, there's a line in the sand at 1%. If we breach that and go to 1.03, all hell's going to break loose. No, that's not the fact. This is right where we peaked out earlier in the year, back in early November. And clearly it's the highest level since March, when all of the weakness in the bond yield started, because of course the Fed has come in and specifically lowered down interest rates to emergency level lending rate levels due to the fact that they want to get money flushed out into the system. So we're going to see a lot more coming up in the next few weeks. Obviously, the monthly CPI and PPI numbers coming out next week. And, you know, from all accounts, we don't really have any inflation on a statistical measure. We talked about that earlier, the idea of, you know, what are statistics until it really hits me. I don't know about you, but even as I'm paying more for whether it's, any of my housing costs of utilities and things like that, food prices are up. I've been hearing a lot of stories about people paying full sticker price for new cars, and used car prices are absolutely through the roof. Housing prices are up. We had one of the best months on a year-over-year basis on the Case-Shiller numbers last month on housing prices, but yet there's little official, quote, put those air quotes up there. There's little official inflation. And that's good with respect to how the Fed will handle things. And the Fed has made it very clear. There's no, it's not something like, well, I wonder what they're thinking here. Are they saying this and meaning that? No. The Fed has made it very clear. They're not even thinking about the thought of raising rates. They're not even thinking about the concept of thinking about what we would do. They're so far out with this into the 2022, 2023 year because they want the job market to come back somewhere in the normal levels, which, what's normal these days and what is normal going to be? I mean, especially because, again, now we have a different kind of statistics that make things look a little warped, where we use the labor participation rate to calculate the unemployment rate. And the more people that are out of work and out of the workforce, specifically not looking for jobs in an environment like this, kind of helps the unemployment rate a little bit because the way they calculate it. So right now, the last reading we had, that was last Friday, came out, was for a 6.7% unemployment rate. We've seen over 700,000 initial claims on a weekly basis and a very disappointing employment report this week. But things are, generally slowly, a very slow process of getting better. Now, there's some headwinds and there's some other issues, and I want to talk about that. Before we do that, I want you to listen to this. This is important because I want to talk about portfolio analyst, because this is through a company that I've told you about for years, right? Interactive Brokers. And what they do is help sophisticated investors understand the health of their complete financial portfolio. And Portfolio Analyst is free. It's easy to use. And what this is personal finance software that creates a consolidated view of banking and brokerage and credit card accounts. And what you could do is compare your consolidated portfolio against more than 200 benchmarks, or even create a customized benchmark for analyzing performance of your portfolio. You can do things like calculate time and money-weighted rates of return and use Portfolio Analyst for forecasting. That's what's really interesting. Now, the good news is, this is great news actually, because you can sign up for free. What I want you to do is go to PortfolioAnalyst.com. Again, powered by Interactive Brokers. PortfolioAnalyst.com. We'll put links in the show notes for this episode as well. So we're talking about now inflation. We're also talking about economics. We're talking about the potential for a slowdown. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There are signs that there is a slowdown coming. Now, we discussed this over the last, I would say, several shows about some of the key economic numbers that are coming out, and that what they're kind of showing us is there is this still tepid recovery that's going on. Economists have no idea what really is happening. They're so far off because this is all new. This whole deal with the shutdowns, the lockdowns, the stay-at-home orders, the, go back to work. Well, don't go back to work. Shut down at 10, don't you? It's all very new to the economic modeling. That is something that is, there's nothing written on this. There was nothing thought of being written on this. So what we're finding, though, is that there is this continuation of this economic recovery. And you would have to expect that with the low interest rates that we have, the massive stimulus that's been poured in, not only in the U.S., but around the world as well. I mean, you look at some of the other countries that have been very aggressive with their stimulus, and some of the other ones like in Asia, which have done really well as of right now. I mean, South Korea recently came out over the weekend that they're starting to think about putting more restrictions on because they have the highest number of new cases in, I think, 9 months or so. So that's obviously from the beginning. And we're possibly starting to continue seeing the, this really big issue with regard to, you know, where this pandemic is going, even though we have all this great news that is baked in about the vaccine. So one of the things that we're seeing is that while we have this incredible story that there is this recovery happening, it's starting to slip a little bit. And rightfully so, if you think about the trend of how money coming into the markets through a stimulus, that, you know, how that flows through. And because we've had such a stalemate in Congress with trying to get through this next level of stimulus, and how that has stalled, and how we've seen a reduction in that incredible amount of money that came out in the beginning, whether it was the $1,200 stimulus checks plus, or whether it was the $600 per week plus, that was being paid for unemployment, that's kind of dried up by now. So now what we're having is a lot of discussion about the first quarter of 2021. And you'd have to expect, just by the very nature of how we've seen this recovery, we're actually going back to the second quarter with the massive drop that we saw in the economic activity that, you know, kind of stretched out until all of a sudden with all the stimulus and, you know, the lockdowns being lifted, how it turned around. We saw one of the worst quarters, if not the worst quarter of GDP, followed by the best quarter of GDP ever. And you would expect now what we're going to find is we're going to have a very choppy situation. So therefore, we're seeing firms like JP Morgan and a couple of others saying we're probably going to see a negative print on GDP in the first quarter of 2021, which doesn't seem too far off, to be honest with you. Because we're seeing, you know, this slowdown in the employment numbers and in some of these services, but again, not terrible. I mean, it's not like, oh wow, that's bad. No, just little small indications that things are, you know, changing a little bit. But I think what's happening with regard to markets is that they're saying, well, you know what? It's not getting so bad or really worse that it's a problem. And particularly when we look at like yields on fixed income, there was a big concern that we saw this recovery that was going to be just an absolute devastation to certain areas of the market. But remember that this rise that we're seeing is commensurate with a recovery, and that's a good thing. So I think what's happening is when we talk about yields and we talk about the idea of the economics, it makes sense. Finally, something's making sense, actually, that yields will start to move up, even though the Fed is trying to press them down dramatically, into where we are seeing a recovery of the economy. But the rise is not only that, right? It's also looking like we're still just in a very simple range. I mean, right now, there's way too much debt that's floated out there on the corporate level and sovereign or the world level overall that's going to allow for any meaningful rise in rates unless something really weird happens with regard to the standing of the central banks and their ability to keep rates down, because they need to keep rates down. They can't afford to have rates going up with the amount, I mean, and the amount is staggering. Let's be honest. I mean, let's call it for what it is. It is obscene, the amount of debt that we are utilizing to fund all of this. I mean, because gosh forbid anything fails, we can't even have the companies that are bankrupt going through bankruptcy. I mean, I've been hearing bankrupt companies, people talking about buying the shares of the common stock. We all know. But one of the first things that happens when you have one of the things that happens that's kind of like, okay, this is going to happen through a bankruptcy proceeding is that they're going to wipe out the common shareholders. But somehow these things are still trading and people are thinking that, you know what, maybe somehow miraculously after the bankruptcy, this company's going to do a lot better. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, wait a second. For the most part, bankruptcies yield a total loss of the common stock. And why would you even be putting your money in there for the long haul? It's one thing if you want to trade it for some really strange and, I don't know, some reason that you feel that this is a good deal. I don't know. So when it comes to these interest rates and it comes to where we're going with this, I think we're in a range. I think the fact is that the idea of the move up that we've seen lately is good. It is representative of what is happening with the underlying economy. However, I don't think that the Fed is going to allow, or central banks around the world are going to allow, too much more of an increase due to the fact that we have to keep on funneling in more and more debt. Now, the truth is that low rates are good for everyone. We know that. And if we foster the idea that more stimulus can be added, if we think about low rates and low inflation conceptually, it allows for the very basic notion that we can float more debt to provide further stimulative action for an economy. But until there's such time that there is a backup plan to bring money into the system to offset these higher rates paid, rates are going to stay down low for a long period of time. And what I mean by that is this. It's very simple if you think about the math for a second. We know the central bank's basically pulling on the strings of the puppets that are the legislators that are issuing the debt and saying, you know what, hey, you know what? You can issue a lot of debt because we're going to keep rates low. Because we're going to keep rates low, that means that you issue debt, you're going to pay a lot less than you really should be paying on this debt. And then, therefore, when they roll over and you have to reinvest that, we're going to keep it even rates low then, too. I mean, come on. It's a nod and a wink. We know what's happening. It's not a bad thing or a good thing. It's a fact. We know what's happening. But they can't raise rates very dramatically because that would be a significant dampening effect for the markets. Because if you do that, what happens is that they're not going to be able to effectively manage this massive debt pile, whether it is treasuries or corporates or govies, whatever you want to look at, is not going to be manageable. Because when that debt starts to roll over, or when new debt needs to be issued in order to fund what's going on, the fact is that there's no way they'll be able to really have a ability to service that debt at those extremely high levels. We already know that the S&P small cap index out there, some just untenable amount in a percentage basis of the companies are considered zombies, where the income and revenue that they have coming in are just not enough to actually pay for the debt service. But they keep on adding it because rates are low and they can keep on rolling it. And there's an incredible appetite for that debt. So the question, though, is that a lot of people are asking is, how could higher rates impact yield-related plays? For example, things like real estate, utilities, some long bonds, and other interest rate-sensitive instruments, right? Because it's something to consider. Because while the move from 50 basis points on the 10-year to 1% now doesn't seem like a lot in raw numbers, it's a doubling of where we were. It's real. And it had an impact. We could look at, for example, as a proxy, one of the things that I like to just, you know, keep on my screen to look at, aside from just the actual yields and the pricing, you could just look at TLT, which is an ETF, which is the iShares 20-plus year Treasury ETF, I think it's called. And we can look at the price, and this is just price-based. It's not necessarily combining in the dividend and the total return. But in August, the price was high. The high price was about, I think it was right about 170. And now we're trading somewhere at about 155. So we're talking about 8.5%, 9% drop during the last few months. So that's kind of That's significant. And this is the reason, actually, we've stayed away from the longer end of the curve. While there's an opportunity, if you want to participate in some of the trading of bonds and you think that you can manage your process by looking at, okay, right now it looks like I want to be in long bonds and I'm going to take it out when we hit these levels and trade it. I am not a big advocate of trying to trade bonds like we do stocks, right? Like the concept of, okay, we have these funds, we have this area, there's momentum moving into there. We want to be into this sector, that sector. There's a little bit of a difference, you know, in the level of bonds, even though there is some important attributes that you want to pay attention to with regard to where you are with your bond investments. But we have this situation where we saw this, you know, 8 or 9% drop, which again, relatively significant when you think about this. It doesn't feel like there is going to be a significant amount of opportunity for us to, you know, look at negative rates in terms of at least in the U.S. And a lot of people are playing that long bond exposure, thinking that there's going to be, you know, this potential for further drop of the yield into the future and possibly negative rates. I'm not buying it necessarily. I'm just not thinking that there's really the, at least from what the Fed has been transmitting for a while now. Now let's stop. We're talking about this whole idea of a curve, the yield curve. And I talk about that a lot. Talk about the yield curve. And I have this sneaking feeling that there's some of you that are listening and saying, okay, great, but what in fact is the yield curve? So I wanted to take a second, kind of, here's your educational moment here on this episode, on what exactly is the yield curve, at least as best to my explanation abilities. So I want you to think about a range of rates for differing maturities of bonds. So let's say, for example, we have the U.S. Treasuries. And we can look at things like the short-term T-bills. And again, this is just a broad brush look at this concept of what is a yield curve. And let's look at, for example, a one-month T-bill that rolls in 26 week, short-term debt that rolls, that matures every month or so. And we can plot the price of that on a chart. We can say, okay, we have a chart with an X and Y axis. We put on the X axis, we put the maturities. On the Y axis, we put their current yield. So if we take a point, we say, okay, well, that one-month treasury is yielding 0.02%. And we kind of go out and we say, okay, across the X axis, we say, okay, well, we have a 2-year, we have a 10-year, we have a 20-year, a 30-year. We don't go throughout the process. And then, you know, kind of like an XY axis of the chart, keep on connecting or really placing the dots on there. And then let's connect those dots. And what we get is the current curve from the leftmost part of the chart where we have our shorter maturities and the bottom left, which we have the shorter maturities and the shorter, the lower rates, to the top right where we have our longer maturities as well as having our yields that could, you know, be a lot higher. So what happens is when we have this curve, this connected dots of all of these that we strung together, we get a normal curve we talk about, which is when we look at this line, this connected dots of this line that we created, that is a normal curve is kind of swinging from bottom left to top right, not a straight line, but it gradually moves up and then kind of sparks a little bit higher towards the end on a much more of an incline. So you kind of get this level of a long-term move slightly higher from left to right, and then it kind of picks up speed and moves up to the, you know, so you get this kind of curve. It doesn't have to be rip-roaring or anything, but that's kind of what a normal curve looks like. In other words, shorter-term rates are lower than longer-term rates. Kind of basic yield curve 101. So when they say there's an inverted curve, what does that mean, right? So it's kind of exactly the opposite to a degree, where basically the short-term rates are higher than the longer, which is not a good situation for the economy. It acts like a wet blanket on banks and lending. Because if you think about where banks make their money, they basically do their lending on the long end of the curve, and they basically do their taking their money in at the short end of the curve. So when they take money in, they have to pay you the interest rate on that. So if it's lower than what they're lending, that's a good, you know, good margin of profitability. If for whatever reason the short end of the curve is higher than the long end, what happens is you end up with a problem. And the problem is that they're paying more, or at least not making enough to cover their debt service on what they have in the savings accounts, etc. So that's not a good thing. Then you have a flat curve, which is kind of what it sounds like. There's very little convexity from left to right. Short-term bond rates are still lower than long-term bond rates, but it's not like a big a move from bottom left to top right. Again, the best example of where we are when it is beneficial for the economy is a normal curve. Flat curve is really not great. An inverted curve is really bad. And this is really important to understand. There's a lot of different variations of all this too, but there's a lot of things to take from this. And it's actually, I think, really important to understand that how this yield curve can shape the flow of money into an economy. So it's something to pay attention to. So now we're back to the question where we are with regard to if higher rates, if we can call it what that is, if that's higher rates, if the 10-year approaching 1% is like, oh, look at that, it's high. I mean, come on. Seriously, it's not high. But how much is that going to impact the skew of bonds to stocks and other sectors? Because the question is starting to come up, well, if rates are coming up, does the risk-reward trade-off make sense to still be invested in stocks? And what about those hefty and lofty stock valuations that we're seeing right now that have been justified by a low, an ultra, a super, a crazy, a historically low interest rate? And it's moving up now. So when we calculate that discount model where we can look at a risk-free rate of return and say, okay, you know what? Because rates are so low, a lot is going on there. And one of the things that we know is that it's acceptable. Maybe not always, but right now it's acceptable that we can have these valuations that are so stretched due to the fact that rates are low. But now when rates are coming up a little bit, you're going to start hearing that, well, that's good because that means the economy is doing well. And when that happens, it's also good for stocks. Everything's good for stocks all the time from all the analysts, right? But until we see actually an appreciable move in rates, not really necessarily on a percentage basis, because right now from 50 basis points on the 10-year that we saw up to 1%, it's a 100% increase, right? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about levels like, I don't know, I'll start at 3%. 3% on the 10-year. Because that's about where the dividend yield is on the S&P 500. And while we're in a TINA, T-I-N-A, there is no alternative right now because savers, those that are living off of their hard-earned income and pension plans, et cetera, that have it in savings accounts, et cetera, are unable to utilize it. I mean, who could live off 0.2%? I don't care how much money you have. You know, $10 million, 0.2%, that's not giving you much of an income that you need. So until such time as interest rates come up and possibly eclipse on a 10-year, the level of what you can get on an S&P 500 stock on average from a dividend yield and have the potential for price appreciation in a very low interest rate environment, I don't really think we have to worry too much about where the yields are going. Now, if we do see an event that really ratchets up the yield, I mean, just out of nowhere, That will cause some harm to the areas of utilities and real estate, et cetera. But I don't necessarily know if that's going to be allowable, because once that happens, the Fed is going to come and put their foot on the throat of yields and do some kind of changes to their way of doing business. They'll probably put some yield curve controls on. They'll do some other buying because they have an unlimited pool of money to do so, right? So the idea that you can get yield and upside right now with the motivation to move into bonds with a defined rate in return, if in fact, well, we're going to have maybe negative interest rates, is probably off the table. Possibly we're going to be in this range for some time. And the question then is, you know, where are we going to want to be? And this is precisely why I've been advocating for some time that we want to have an exposure to fixed income, both domestically and internationally, but a little bit on the shorter end of the curve, so we don't have to worry about that tail flapping as we see these moves right here. And when we saw this whole idea of being pushed into asset classes that are maybe not necessarily appropriate risk-wise for some people, where maybe they were pushed into higher yielding bonds, you know, lower grade bonds, or maybe even some leveraged real estate deals. This is the idea of what actually was the plan by the Fed, right? The whole wealth effect. I'm not necessarily sold on the idea that this really works. I'm not saying it's not a good thing, because it's very good when we see our 401k plans and our IRAs and our portfolios doing a lot better over time. But the concept of this wealth effect to try to stimulate the economy is a whole different bag of worms. I mean, the idea that stocks and invested assets moving higher and helping people's pocketbooks and spending habits is well, on paper, it makes sense. However, it's only for those people that have investment portfolios, right? I mean, if you're not able to save for a number of years, you don't have a 401k, you definitely don't have maybe an investment account, how is that helping you? You know, you got to wonder about this, and who are we really trying to help in terms of from a government standpoint? I don't really think the powers that be care about much of the rest of the people, because they're looking for just what can be, you know, very much quantified. And you can see how much value the stock market has made, and that's somewhat good, but they're somewhat blind to the fact that many people are not owners of stocks, even within their 401k plans. And even with all the 401k plans, there may be a lot of people that have only a partial positioning in stocks. So this wealth effect is interesting. I think it does have a place, and it does have some impact on the economic outlook. But kind of, let's, you know, it's not for everybody, unfortunately. It's not helping. But realizing that the push by the governments to have people into risk assets needs to be, you know, thought about by many people who right now are thinking that, wow, what a great run on my bonds over the last number of years. And then it kind of fell off a bit and came right back. And, oh, here we are again. I don't necessarily think bonds are going to stay where we are for a long period of time, even though, yes, over the next year or two, it is possible. I do think, and I'm going to state it again, that we are in interesting times. I think valuations are head scratchers. I think inflation is going to be cropping up in a time when fundamentals are questionable, and a time when we are skeptical about the economic numbers and statistics that are being presented, in a time where we think that there is a central management program. Of course, we know this. There's nothing wrong with this. It's just a fact that is managing all of the money that's pouring into the system, all of the Fed. I do believe that, because in addition to that with the fiscal, and we've talked about this 100 times, there's going to be inflation that's going to push up bonds. Manage your bond portfolio and your interest-sensitive investments accordingly. So kind of going back to that yield curve, make sure you can find a way to track that over time, see how steep it is, how much from the low end to the high end there is that that curvature, and keep an eye on that, especially if you're invested in anything, because that change of the shape can be very much, it can reverberate into other areas of the market, whether it's fixed income or stocks or real estate or alternatives, et cetera. And I do think, and I think many of you agree with me on this, that even though we have some deflationary forces that are out there, like the unemployment situation, like the fact that we have technology that is cutting the cost of many things, like the fact that, you know, obviously we have a pandemic and all, there are a lot of counter-inflationary points as well that are entering our markets, a la fiscal stimulus in the trillions of dollars from around the world. So this leads us into very interesting times. What, again, evaluations are head scratchers, even in this environment, and technical indicators that are, well, a bit hair-raising on certain ones. You kind of look at some of the stocks, how far above. In fact, I think I read some stats from what I was looking at in our recent update that I look at on a regular basis to see kind of where are we from a valuation standpoint. And 450 stocks in the S&P 500 are now over their 200-day moving average, which is good to see, actually, on one hand. You know, you don't always hear both sides, right? It's good to see, because what that means is that we have a broad-based expansion and that it's not just a few stocks that are moving up. We're seeing the continuation of this move of a lot of participation of the broad index, 500 stocks for that, the Russell 3000, the Russell 1000, the Russell 2000. So we're starting to see that there is, or we are seeing that there is, a significant amount of participation. However, this is the highest level that we've seen since 2013, which is the exact opposite, by the way, of what we saw in March of this year, where we saw that big downstroke, everybody selling everything, 450 plus stocks under the 50-day moving average till it started picking up and moving the other direction. In addition to this, our key reversal indicator is starting again to flash a little bit of a hot signal, plus five. Not the worst. Plus five is kind of like, hey, yeah, wake up, something going on. Market's a little hot. That doesn't mean they're going to crash necessarily or anything like that. But you know what? They're getting a little frothy. When we get to a plus six, that's when we start, you know, the bells start going off a little bit. Plus five is telling us, you know, the current trend will probably continue for some time until that frothiness is reduced. Right now, that froth has been reduced historically when we hit these levels about 2 to 3 days after we see the level hit, and it resolves pretty quickly. So something to think about. Question then is, where do we go from here? Well, right now, Congress is not only talking about, but they're just flagrantly screaming out all about the potentials for stimulus. I mean, I counted one day last week, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday, there was like 20 different headlines about 20 different items about the potential for stimulus. They know stocks need fuel into the potential for a slowdown. They know that people after Christmas are going to be running out of their special unemployment compensation, I think the day after Christmas, and that's a problem. And they're doing what they can to get these headlines out to keep people feeling good right now and spending into the Christmas holiday. They have agreements. They're far away. They're close. I'm sure this week we're going to see this happen. I am certain sometime in the beginning of this week, maybe even tonight, Sunday night, we are going to see something like there's a framework, an agreed upon framework. You know, they'll start throwing those out, those kind of conceptual ideas that, oh, we're getting that much closer. And we know that markets want this. And what I mean to say is that every time we get a headline that looks positive for the stimulus, markets react very favorably. When there's something that's, well, maybe we won't get that much, kind of markets zigzag a little bit. But then again, they get another dose of either some vaccine news, which is very favorable for markets, or they get something about this stimulus. That's what's happening right now. We're getting these, I think, trial balloons sent up by Congress to try to get us all warmed up to whatever may be coming. And that's exactly what's happening right now. Beyond that, we'll see. Because I think really all we have on the table right now, and all the good news that really can be baked in at this moment, is all about two things, and it's the vaccine and stimulus. That's what we've known for months. That was what we know today. That's what we're going to know tomorrow. There's not much more that really can be pushed in because you have valuations that are so absurd on some of these levels. And unless we keep that level of excitement with a carrot in front for some time, which I don't know how many more carrots there are to give. So just manage it and manage yourself accordingly. So we talked about the idea of taxes in the future today. We talked about the idea of looking at potentially doing some smart tax moves now, whether it's a required minimum distribution, whether it is necessarily your conversion potentially from a Roth to a from a regular to a Roth IRA. We talked about the yield curve, right? We talked about what that looks like and giving you a conceptualization of how that appears and what is good and what is quote-unquote bad for an economy, as well as inflation and the future of interest rates and alternative and the interest rate-sensitive investments. So I think we got a lot accomplished today. So I'm happy about that. Listen, thanks again for being here. Thanks again for being here every week. We'll have some more things lined up for next week. Some great guests that we are queuing up, we're finishing up and confirming over the next several weeks. Thank you so much for your emails. Check out all that we have to offer over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's where you'll find Investology strategy, the TDI managed growth strategy, the long short strategy we manage, as well as information on the global allocation strategy. For those of you that are like, hey, you know what? I want some decent input and insight and a management of this where I don't have to think about as much as these big wirehouse brokers that keep on feeding me their nonsense or whatever's happening. I had a couple of conversations last week. That's why I'm bringing this up about just this, that wirehouse is not paying attention, not listening. And I'm not going to name any of them, so I don't have a problem with them. But you know who I'm talking about. Something you want to talk about? Something you want us to look at? We'll take a look at your portfolio, see what we can come up with, maybe tweak it a bit, work it a bit, and find out a situation that could be better for you in the future. But for now, I'm going to wish you a great weekend, a great week ahead, and I'll see you again next week. Thanks for joining me. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.